Hello, I'm Manila Chan. You are tuned into Modus Operandi. The political lexicon gets a rebrand, traditionally called a coup d'etat, now coined regime change. But the deadly results remain the same. This week, we'll examine the anatomy of a coup. What's it look like? How does one develop? And who is most often to blame for them? Former U.S. Marine Corps intelligence officer turned U.N. weapons inspector Scott Ritter shed some light on the issue. All right, let's get into the MO. I say tomato, you say tomato. I say coup, the U.S. government says regime change. When one party or group assumes power by force, that usually leads to a lot of bloodshed. Whatever the word game, that's known the world over as a coup d'etat. But in the age of social media, sensitivity and kindness, in recent years, terms like bloody coup are a thing of the 20th century. In the 21st century, pop culture as dictated by and proliferated by the U.S. State Department, we now call it regime change. Toppling whoever is labeled a dictator, authoritarian, or despot, regime change is much better packaging for selling a war of destabilization against another country, or sometimes even against your own. So what is the MO behind a coup? I mean, regime change. How do they spring up? Or are they actually grown? So for that, let's turn to a military expert with international experience. He was one of the first voices to blow the whistle on WMDs in Iraq, which we know ultimately found Saddam Hussein to be on the receiving end of regime change. Scott Ritter is a former U.S. Marine Corps intelligence officer and later became a U.N. weapons inspector. Scott, always good to see you. A coup. Coup, that's a four-letter word. The U.S. government has largely purged that sort of language from its official lexicon. The term is now regime change. Recently, we heard President Biden and others in his administration say the quiet part out loud in regard to Vladimir Putin. They said this proxy war in Ukraine is actually about regime change. So let's first address the shift in language here. Why doesn't the U.S. use the term coup anymore?
Well, I mean, as you said, it's a four-letter word. It's a dirty word. There's a lot of negative connotation attached to it. Many U.S.-supported coups in the past have produced leadership of that has been embarrassing to the United States. It's also something that flies in the face of international law. A coup implies that we are actively supporting a military junta to forcefully take over from a government, oftentimes a democratically elected government. We don't want to encourage that anymore. So we speak of regime change. See, a regime change could be as simple as an election. That you voted out a regime. It's very harmless, you see, bloodless, nobody gets hurt. Regime change can also reflect the independent will of a sovereign people who have decided to liberate themselves from an oppressive regime. This is why, in the case of Maidan in Ukraine in 2014, we speak of a revolution, a regime change, where the people ousted the pro-Russian Viktor Yanukovych. We don't admit that it was a coup d'etat carried out by Ukrainian ultra-nationalists funded and supported by the United States. One would be a blatant violation of international law. The other one is the lawful expression of free will by a sovereign people. And indeed, if one takes a look at the sanctions that were imposed on Russia because of the special military operation, this was a regime change operation. This was about bringing harm to the Russian people of such a scope and scale that the Russian people would become alienated, disenfranchised from the Russian government and rise up and remove Vladimir Putin from power. A regime change, but never a coup.
And what are the characteristics of a coup? How might one know if they were being couped?
Generally speaking, when we speak of a coup d'etat, and the implication is military. So the first key is that there are guns involved. There's usually violence involved or the threat of violence. Regime change, as I said, it's a more, warm and fuzzy thing, an election, maybe a demonstration. But a coup is guys in uniforms kicking the door down, pointing guns in your face, saying your day is done, you're finished. Sometimes they shoot you. Other times they arrest you. Sometimes they just escort you out, put you on an airplane and fly you off. But generally speaking, when we speak of a coup, it's men in uniforms who are coming in, forcefully removing from power, and then in replacing you with martial law, because the genesis of the coup is some sort of dissatisfaction towards the kind of constitutional rule that has been transpiring. So the idea is to suspend the Constitution, replace it with martial law, and then the military will work to restructure society in a way that suits their needs. And then and only then, they may seek to transfer power back to civilians. But this time, the civilian population will understand that if they get out of step one more time, they'll be couped again. I mean, one only has to take a look at the history of Turkey recently, where they had a succession in 1960s, 70s, 80s, 90s of military coups. You knew it was a coup as tanks were in the street.
All right, so I've heard sociologists say that one of the things that are part and parcel of a coup d'etat is being able to shift public opinion. Language is one of those methods. It's one of those tools. What would you say are other methods of fomenting a coup?
I think one of the key aspects, if you're going to foment a coup, is to create economic discomfort. It's hard for a military to successfully carry out a coup when the population is satisfied with the government power. And, it comes back down to James Carville and the advice he gave to Bill Clinton when Bill Clinton was first running for president. Stop talking about foreign policy and all this. It's the economy, stupid. And that's a lesson that, every American politician understands. At the end of the day, it's about, are you better off today than you were when the current power came in to power? And if the answer is no, then they run a risk of, being ousted by an election. But if you're going to do a coup, you're bypassing the election. You're going straight to the ouster part. But one of the ways that you want to foment a coup is to take advantage of, economic difficulty, to alienate the people from the government by pointing out that the reason why they're suffering economically is because of the bad policies of the government. You generally want to tie the economic difficulties to notions of corruption, that these are the people you entrusted to look out for your welfare, but instead of looking out for you, they're only looking out for themselves. They're enriching themselves, offshore bank accounts and stuff. So you want to create this mythology. In many cases, it's probably true of corruption of a leadership elite out of touch with the people. So these are the kind of sentiments you want to have, because one of the most vulnerable periods of a coup is when it first happened. I mean, the only person more scared than the president that's being forcefully removed from power is the people doing it, because you've just taken a big step into the unknown. If a coup fails, you're oftentimes accused of treason and you get put up against the wall and you get shot, or you're the one being sent on exile. And one of the best ways to make a coup fail is that the people go to the streets.
All right, so let me get this straight. Sanctions then are probably likely a tool then to help foment a coup?
The United States, in its infinite wisdom, is under the impression that we can exacerbate the economic tension in a targeted country by imposing sanctions. We did this with Iraq, a place that I have intimate experience with. Our policy early on in the Saddam regime in the post-Gulf War period was that we were hoping that there would be a coup, that we would get his military leadership to apply the 75-cent solution, which is the price of a 9mm bullet in the back of his head, and then replace him with someone that looked like Saddam, talked like Saddam, but just wasn't named Saddam. We needed Saddam gone. That didn't work. So then we went into a prolonged period of trying to apply pressure on Iraq through economic sanctions, under the belief that if we made the Iraqi people suffer, that they would rise up and that generals would recognize the suffering and say, we now need to get get rid of Saddam. That didn't work. Why? Because sanctions generally backfire against those people who are imposing them, either politically or in the case of what's going on with Russia right now, they just actually blow black and you suffer worse economically. With Iraq, what happened is the Iraqi people rallied around their leadership. Instead of alienating the Iraqi people from the Iraqi leadership was to say, the economic suffering that you have right now isn't because of me. It's because of these outside powers that are imposing sanctions. You'll be hard pressed to find any examples of economic sanctions actually working. Generally speaking, when they apply sanctions, they have the opposite effect. Instead of encouraging a coup against a leader you want removed, you actually strengthen the hand of that leader. It's worked against us in Iraq. It's worked against us in Iran. It's working against us in Russia.
All right. So coups are never spontaneous events, right? They are engineered. They're a process. They take time and planning. Civil unrest, for as organic as many of them appear, oftentimes, especially in this day and age, those too are engineered. Who tends to be behind the engineering of today's modern civil unrest, whether, you know, it's domestically or abroad? Can you think of any persons or groups or countries that come to mind?
I mean, coups are socially engineered. And even though we speak of a military coup, it's not the U.S. military's job to go in and create conditions for a coup d'etat. That's the job of the Central Intelligence Agency. And that's who's behind the vast majority of the nefarious actions in the world today. The CIA's job is to go in and manipulate societies. They do that by buying off politicians. They do that by funding oppositions. They do that by deliberately undermining economies. They do that by planting disinformation, by taking control of the media, seeding the media with false narratives or narratives that support their point of view, but by basically by manipulating the society from the inside out. It's done by intelligence services, and the intelligence services that do this more than anybody else are the United States and the British, MI6. I think anywhere you go in the world, if you scratch deep enough, you're going to find the CIA. I'll say this. I mean, I know there's people out there who believe the CIA does good stuff. I used to believe that. I believe that CIA analysis used to be solid back when I was doing the Soviet target. I had high respect for the SOVA division within the CIA that was responsible for Soviet analysis. I even had respect for some of the CIA officers who were working the operation side against the Soviet target. But today, you know, when I take a look at the CIA, they bring nothing positive. If you have a CIA station and an embassy in your country, they're not there to help you. They're not there to help you. They're there to hurt you. Their job isn't to, you know, promote your interest. Their job is there to solely promote the interests of the United States. And even if you think you have a cooperative relationship with them, it's not. It's only cooperative insofar as the CIA views it as being beneficial to a larger intelligence plan, a larger intelligence target. So they're either working with you to try and bring unrest somewhere else in the world, or they're working in your country to foment unrest in your country so that there's an outcome that beneficial to the United States, not necessarily beneficial to you. But I would say the number one bad actor in the world today is the Central Intelligence Agency, which basically exists to create the conditions that further American power, usually at the detriment of the nations that they're involved with.
All right, Scott Ritter, don't go anywhere. There's a ton more to unpack here. Coming up next, can we blame a coup on Mark Zuckerberg? We'll examine the role of social media in modern day coups. We're going to discuss it when we return. Sit tight, the MO will be right back.
The Russian state-controlled narrative.
Als Teil der Sanktionen gegen Russland gehen die westlichen Länder gegen russische Auslandssender vor.
Mais écoutez, ne monsieur, c'est pas à vous de décider de qui est journaliste ou pas dans ce pays. On est en France, quoi, c'est pas possible.
We will ban in the European Union the Kremlin's media machine. The state-owned Russia Today and Sputnik.
RT, Sputnik, even our video agency, roughly, all banned on YouTube.
Et merci à vous tous pour votre fidélité et votre soutien.
Some nations may be able to turn a blind eye to atrocities in other countries. The United States of America is different. Wherever people long to be free, they will find a friend in the United States.
We came here peacefully. We are asking our minimum basic rights in this country as a human being.
Dietro la primavera araba e le varie rivolte nei vari paesi si sono inseriti i giochi delle grandi potenze, dei servizi segreti.
Color revolutions is one among several means to reach the goal of conquering foreign lands and bringing them under the helm of US Western economic interests.
Si può pensare ad un'architettura globale di democrazia.
Le rivoluzioni colorate sono un tassello del soft power americano.
The final goal of these theme revolutions is to ensure that there are no independent players in the world anymore.
Mark Zuckerberg, could some of the 21st century coups be blamed on Facebook? All right, look, I'm not trying to be sued for libel or slander, so I won't lay these issues squarely at his feet, but nowadays, regime change operations happen right before our very eyes on social media. Scott Ritter is joining us again. Scott, thanks for sticking around. Still a lot to talk about. So, in the 20th century, a postmortem of places like Iran, 1953, Chile, 1973, Bolivia, 1980, Iraq, 2001, Libya, 2011, and I believe future historians will refer to Ukraine in 2014 as an example, all had so-called U.S. intervention in lieu of the term coup or regime change operation. What's been the result of U.S. intervention for some of these places?
Well, first thing is, none of these places emerged better after the U.S. intervention than they were before the U.S. intervention. Everything the United States touches when it comes to this kind of activity withers and dies. There's not a single example of where the United States went in and touched a country and said, I'm intervening to achieve a change in regimes, and everything came up smelling roses. It doesn't work that way. Look at Libya under Gaddafi. Prior to, and I'm not sitting here singing the praises of Gaddafi. I'm not going to pretend that he was some sort of wonderful democratic leader and all this stuff. And so he was Gaddafi. We know who he was. What he was is a man who cared about his country. What he was is a man who invested heavily in the infrastructure of his country. And if you take a look at the infrastructure of Libya pre-2011, It was a nation that was doing okay. I mean, they high standard of living, modern, facilities, etc. Post U.S. intervention, Libya is a hellhole. Its economy is in tatters. Its infrastructure ruined. It's a civil war. Nothing good. And we can go across down the road. Every single place that we touch ends up worse off than it was before we touched it.
What happens when a head of state perhaps, say, rejects U.S. aid or intervention?
Oh, well, they probably don't last very long. It's rare to have a leader that says, we don't want your assistance, we don't want your help, we're going to go it our own way. Because normally the United States, we're not a benevolent nation. We don't have a tendency to go out and offer assistance to people just because they need it and out of the kindness of our heart. We offer assistance when it benefits us, when there's an outcome that we desire. And that outcome is usually linked to a geopolitical impact that we want that furthers what we call our national security interests. So a nation refusing help means that they have impeded a process of achieving an outcome that the decision makers have made a decision is necessary for a larger objective. So we can't just simply go, you don't want our help? Gosh, we'll walk away from this one. If you don't want our help, then we're going to find somebody who does want our help. If you reject American assistance, you're rejecting, you're not just rejecting assistance, you're hurting national security. And now you become a threat to the United States, and threats need to be removed. So we'll find a way to remove you.
What role does the traditional legacy media play, if any, in coups? And for this, I'm referring specifically to TV and to print.
Well, normally speaking, traditional legacy media is that which the majority of a population gets their information from. And generally speaking, it's government controlled, depending on where you're in, or government influenced. Even here in the United States, the people who report on government things know that they're hostages to certain sources of information that are comprised primarily of anonymous senior level government officials who feed them data that allows them to have a headline story. You remove the government source, you really have got nothing. So legacy media is there to promote a way of thinking. So you can either gain control of the legacy media if you're the CIA and start planting stories that undermine faith in the government. Or if you're the government, you can seize control yourself and only put forward stories that are favorable to you. This is why there's a new kind of media, the social media, the Facebooks, the Twitters, Telegram, whatever, that's out there that allows an end around to be put there. But even then, that's not as effective as one would think. The United States has called it digital democracy, where we use these social media platforms to engender public unrest. It hasn't been successful. It failed in Egypt. It failed in Iran. It failed in Turkey. It's failing in Russia. It failed just about everywhere that we've tried to use it. And the other thing about legacy media is that it can be used by the government to sell a mission. So let's say the U.S. legacy media, one would think that, Russia would try to exploit it to alter, the point of view in the United States. But we use it, the United States government uses it, to shape American opinion and indeed try and influence opinion abroad, because American media has historically had a rather positive cachet attached to it. People were like, when Walter Cronkite speaks, people listen. But that day is gone. There are no more Walter Cronkites in American media. American media is a total sellout to the U.S. government. We see that in Ukraine today, where it has become a veritable stenographer for deliberately misleading and falsified intelligence information leaked by the U.S. government. They've even acknowledged it. They've admitted it. Yeah, we're leaking stuff. We know it's not true, but we want to get it out there to shape perception. And that's the role of the media today, to shape perception. It's no longer to inform people. It's to shape perception. And that means you're not the media. That just means you're a simple propaganda outlet.
And, as you mentioned, in today's day and age, social media deserves a whole separate address. Social media plays an outsized role in our everyday lives. What's their impact on coups?
I was involved with Iraq back when there wasn't meaningful social media. So we dealt primarily with the legacy media. And one of the ways that we fomented or supported the notion of a coup in Iraq was to pre-program the American public, to get them to accept at face value anything negative that was said about Saddam Hussein and Saddam Hussein's Iraq. And that was largely successful. I mean, I was somebody who was empowered with truth. Firsthand truth. I did the job for 7 years. There was no one had better access to the reality of Iraqi's weapons of mass destruction status than me. I couldn't get traction in the mainstream media. They were very successful in downplaying what I had to say and exaggerating counter opinions. Today, we have a situation in Ukraine where I have taken a contrarian position to the mainstream narrative, and I was able to gain some traction in social media because it's not controlled, or at least we thought it wasn't controlled by mainstream media. But what we found out is it actually is. thanks to the 2016-2020 elections, the United States Congress and the powers that be have determined that social media is a direct threat to American democracy because the people who access social media can't be controlled by a narrative of that's being shaped by mainstream media. There's alternatives. So the government has put pressure on social media to silence voices of dissent. And I, of course, been famously banned from Twitter. What control does this have on coups? The United States, again, has for some time now been trying to implement a policy of what we call a digital democracy. It's basically using social media to foment social unrest that can lead to regime change type activities in targeted nations. Iran has been famously targeted for this, the 2009 Green Revolution. What's going on today in regards to the poor lady who was who lost her life in police custody over a hijab. Was she murdered by the Iranians? No, she died of a heart attack, apparently, according to a video. But that didn't stop the CIA and MI6 and other foreign elements using social media to create a narrative, to create a perception inside Iran that fomented unrest. And that's the role of social media today in that regard. But it's not succeeded. There's a couple reasons why. One, social media is internet-based, and the internet can be turned off, and that's the end of it. And two, the social media works, two ways. You can promote your idea, but there's a lot of other ideas out there. So oftentimes, the targeted information package you're trying to get out gets diluted by other information that's competing for time and space on the social media. It's an imperfect platform. A lot of people believe there's promise and hope in it for changing the way people think. But at the end of the day, people think the way they're going to think, and a tweet or a Facebook posting isn't going to change that reality.
Scott Ritter, thank you so much for staying with us to talk about this. So as you can see, a rose by any other name. All right, forget it. At the end of the day, coups, regime change, intervention, whatever you want to call it, the end result is the same. Destabilizing of that country, blood, death, violence. You get the picture. Coups are inherently undemocratic, yet the hegemons who aid in this sort of political destabilization purport to be spreading democracy. Ironic. That's going to do it for this week's episode of Modus Operandi, the show that digs deep into foreign policy. I'm your host, Manila Chan. Thank you for tuning in. We'll see you again next week to figure out the MO.